The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
All right, everybody, welcome to part two of this particular program, The Orthodox Nationalist. We're dealing with medieval political theory and social ideas. And last week, we dealt with John of Salisbury, Giraldus Cambrensis, and Gilbert of Tournai. And we're going to continue this up until the end of the 14th century. We're going to start with somebody named William Perrault, and he is, like all of these guys, he's a royalist, but he holds that the Republican idea, which was still, you know, popular from the Greek era, the Italians, is problematic. The great evil of republics is that everybody is striving for their own private end, their own selfish end, and that this ultimately is the great evil of republican government, and that it creates the greatest of evils, and that is oligarchy. Nevertheless, the prince, the monarch, does receive his commission from his subjects. So Perrault, not, you know, a Democrat by any means, does hold in this organic analogy that we dealt with last week that the head is truly the monarch of the body, but it's the body that sustains the head. And so he's able to turn the organic analogy on its head, and is able to answer people like John of Salisbury in that regard. Perrault holds to this view that, and you see this is very common in the Middle Ages, that the monarch is the pattern, is an icon, is a living, breathing icon that provides for the moral health of his subjects. So a dissolute prince will help create a dissolute population. That really the ultimate virtue of a ruler, in Perrault's point of view, is self-conquest. The idea that a good ruler does not allow his anger or his emotions of any kind interfere with his ruling and his ability. And this leads to a mentality of compassion and humility. And there's really nobody that we're dealing with here at all in the High Middle Ages that rejects the concept of humility and this idea of the iconic role of the ruler. The ruler is not just someone that passes laws or enforces laws. He is the very standard of conduct for the population. That any prince ruling in Christendom must be pious, and he must not set any store by a life of pleasure. He must live as one of the people. And you see this in Tsar Alexander III in Russia, who was far more happy and at home in the barracks than he was in the palace. And Perrault does have one concept here, and that is the idea of really the fear of prosperity. And I think really what he means, and remember, you know, he's talking in France, the beginning of the modern money economy, and he's really talking about the domination of usury, of the loan shark, of the bank. Remember, in Italy, you have the domination of the Medici clan in Florence and elsewhere. That prosperity really means the dominance of the oligarchical element. It doesn't mean that people are doing well. But what needs to be feared is the overwhelming domination of money. And yet, at the same time, he does hold that taxes should remain low and that war is to be avoided at almost all costs. William Perrault is one of these people that holds to the view that the state really feeds on war, and that the state as an entity can grow in power and authoritarianism relative to warfare. The more wars, the more powerful the state becomes. So Perot holds to this view that the ruler, the prince, needs to be loved rather than feared. It's something that comes up quite often in medieval social theory. And also that good counsel must always be maintained. None of the people who were dealing with medieval social ideas in any regard believes in absolute monarchy. None of them do, because there is no such entity. All monarchs are dependent on their counselors, on certain noble families that advise the monarch, on military and religious power. But this also is about properly advising the ruler. Perot also holds to the view, and this is going to come up again and again, actually, that the queen, wife of the king, must be chosen very carefully and not chosen from political considerations. The queen is, and should be at least, the chief counselor of the monarch, should be in charge of the raising of the next generation of the royal house. And this particular point of view is also important. People like Egidius Romanus, also holding to the view that the wife, the queen, is the chief counselor, and therefore has to be chosen not on the basis of political consideration, but on the basis of intelligence, ability, literacy, knowledge of the political climate of the world that they live in. And both of these men, Romanus and Perot, also hold to the view that education should not be the domain of the elite, that it should be widely diffused. If you are a good ruler, if you are a virtuous ruler, then you have nothing to fear from the education of your subjects. Romanus is one of the first people to really begin to write substantially on the development of a strong middle class in European societies. He holds to a regime of low taxes and to a regime that begins to foster the independence of strong, financially successful cities. Egidius Romanus is one of these people who really begins this almost modern concern with the urban life and with the life of a middle class dominating these cities that is very much involved with the money economy. He holds that any ruler needs to be moderate, needs to be dignified, but he does not hold to the view that there should be this kind of Italian urban oligarchy. And this was the problem in places like Venice and Florence, where an oligarchy of bankers were able to hide behind, the Medicis obviously being the dominant element, being able to hide behind political forms, which of course they controlled secretly. And this was the Medici secret of political rule. Egidius Romanus holds to the view that while it's true the money economy has positive side effects, the urban economy has positive side effects, this should not be the sole end of government. Virtue is the sole end of government. The moral conclusion is that the common good, this is the case in Romanus and in Perot, the common good is the dominant element in any kind of decision making. Therefore, the money economy is only worthwhile to the extent that it is used for the common good of the population, not for the common good of the banking class, or the particular good, I should say, of the banking class that you had in places like Florence. But like all of these people, you also have a stress on free speech. The idea that the governors of the realm, the intellectuals of the realm, the writers of the realm, the ecclesiastics of the realm, should be permitted to speak their mind freely without fear of punishment on any particular question whatsoever. This comes up again and again in the political theory of the High Middle Ages. Romanus holds to the view that law really is based ultimately on custom. The idea that communities within the realm have devised their own way of solving problems, and that no monarchy has any right to interfere with this. This was the position of the anti-federalists in the early part of the constitutional debates, that states and communities and localities, counties, regions have long devised their own methods of dealing with conflict. And the federal government or even state governments don't have any right to interfere. And, you know, the first real explicit mentality reflecting this comes from Egidius Romanus in the High Middle Ages. There are two other Frenchmen I want to mention here, Jacques de Saussole and Pierre Dubois. These two men are firm monarchists in the High Middle Ages. And Jacques, at least, holds to the view of hereditary monarchy. He likes the idea that the forces that control an election have nothing to do with the creation of children. And Jacques de Saussole holds to the concept that an election of any official is really nothing other than the domination of private moneyed or landed interests over the state. And the state is dedicated to the common good, and therefore the particular interests that control elections, and again, I have no doubt that these guys are looking to the Italians, particularly the Florentines in this respect, really is a domination of those who have money and those who have access to the halls of power. So, de Saussole has this concept of hereditary monarchy being the fairest, based on the idea that it comes from it comes from heredity and childbearing, rather than the manipulation of the process from moneyed or landed interests. Jacques de Saussole has this concept that self-interest can never be the basis of any rational government. The whole point of government is that we deal with what is good for everybody, the common good of the society, not the particular interests of those who are dominant. If you hold to the view that those who are able to control the state do so on the basis of self-interest, and self-interest being the basis of moral right and wrong, if you hold to that point of view, all you really do is empower those entities that have the most money, the most land, the most access to the halls of power. De Saussole is one of these people that holds to the view that justice and the common good works for the state because it's the only benefit of the state. If the state was merely a manifestation of private interest, there would be no moral justification for the state whatsoever. Justice is identical to the common good, and what this means in reality is that particular interests need to be eliminated from the state, and therefore the only rational conclusion is hereditary monarchy. Now, at the same time, he holds to the view that free speech is absolutely essential. I want to say that in, you know, in the last hour and a half that we've been dealing with these topics of medieval social thought, political theory in particular, free speech has come up again and again and again as absolutely essential, at least for those people who have been brought into the confidence of the monarchy. Now, when it comes to the question of the common good, there's absolutely no doubt that everybody who is literate and intelligent and who knows their history has a right to talk and has a right to be taken seriously. Jacques de Saussole is one of these people that holds to the view that absolute authority is just another way of saying absolute responsibility. And I want to throw something out here at this stage, that those who have defended some, you know, strange version of absolute monarchy, have all at one point in their careers maintained that what they mean by the word absolute doesn't have anything to do with the exercise of authority. They could never really mean that, because a monarchy that has absolute control over a society has to rule through a whole bunch of intermediaries and bureaucrats and military people and religious people and those with economic power and everything else. So absolute power does not exist. It can't possibly exist. What does exist, however, is absolute responsibility. That when something goes wrong in the society, even if it isn't the direct fault of the monarch, by virtue of their privileged position, is responsible for that problem. I mean, you still hear some shades of that. You know, when something goes wrong in the economy, someone blames the president, as if the president, A, knows anything about the economy, B, has any real control over the economy, and C, could really do anything about the economy. None of those things are true, usually. And of course the president can't be blamed for economic prosperity or economic depression. It has nothing to do with the president. It has to do with business leaders and the domination of money and capital and the Fed and everybody else. And people like Jacques de Sicilia holds to the view that absolute monarchy does not mean absolute power. It means absolute responsibility. They have total responsibility for everything that occurs on their watch. But like everybody else, he also holds to the view that a queen is very important. A queen has to be chosen based on her political acumen. Now, people like Pierre Dubois, writing in the same era in France, is also interested in the development of a middle class. He believes in peace. He believes in the rejection of warfare by the state, because only in peacetime can a rational economy and scientific progress develop. And that a constant state of warfare, constant civil war, constant civil strife, leads not to justice, but to brutalization. This constant idea that governments can change constantly, that people can be executed, people can be thrown in prison for political crimes. Ultimately, dissent in civil war leads to the complete rejection of the sanctity of human life. Dubois holds to the concept that the real role of a monarchy is to deal with major cases, to deal with your very powerful church and economic figures. Let your ministers and bureaucrats take care of everybody else. You as a monarch have to hold to the view that the common good is dominant, the private good of the powerful is not. That private interests, private money, private power could never lead to the domination of the state or of the society, like you have in the Enlightenment world in Western Europe. All of these high medieval figures are fighting for a middle class, a peaceful realm, a unified realm. They believe in economic and scientific progress, and we're talking here maybe 100, 150 years before the traditional start of the Enlightenment. So I don't like this idea that, you know, no one cared about science before 1500. That's nonsense. These guys are holding to a very different view. But nevertheless, they're opposing what is later to develop as the Enlightenment idea of social ideology. Pierre Dubois is somebody really worth discussing, and it's kind of odd why he isn't dealt with more. He believes in what we have now come to call the New World Order. Pierre Dubois is a papist in the strong, powerful sense of that word. He believes in full globalization with the Pope of Rome as its head. He's one of the first people to really develop this concept of international arbitration, and that the wise men of every realm should come together in international tribunals to solve the problems of, at least in his case, Christendom. No greed, no bribery, and therefore they must be wealthy people, wealthy men, to dominate these things. And ultimately, the Church of Rome, the Pope of Rome, should be the final judge of world peace. And it's worthwhile to mention Dubois for no other reason than he holds to the view that if science and technology and economics are to develop in the Western world, there needs to be a lack of diversion of resources to warfare. And instead, those resources should be invested in domestic, what we would call today, domestic progress. Dubois is an interesting writer. You know, he's talking about this stuff in the 14th century, the end of the 13th century. And you know, he also attacks the bankers. He says that the debasing of the coinage, the clipping of coins, the adding of copper to silver coins, et cetera, this is one of the ways that the banking clans dominate human society. He believes that a lot of social problems, overpopulation, land not being sufficient for people, can be solved through immigration. Immigration to new lands, new societies that are more or less empty. And then he does believe that at least among Christian peoples, European peoples, North Africa, parts of the Middle East, etc., there needs to be a better understanding of nations and peoples and societies in order to promote world peace. So Pierre Dubois is one of the earlier manifestations of the so-called diversity ideology, but he certainly cannot be used as an icon by these people because he rejects the mentality of the bankers. He rejects the domination of the currency by the bankers. What he wants is a Christian commonwealth, an international Christian commonwealth controlled by the Pope that will be able not to fight each other with weapons, but to use that investment, scientific, technical acumen into domestic affairs. And you would think that today that people like Dubois would be promoted far more, and yet outside of a handful of specialists and weirdos like me, very few people have ever heard of this man. But he is definitely someone worth talking to. Okay, we're going to take a break right now. Then when we come back, we're going to finish up with Marsilio of Padua in Italy and Tommaso Cleve in Great Britain, and then we're going to bring this to a close. We've been talking about some of the basic ideas of the political ideology and social theory of the High Middle Ages. We'll be right back.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalists. We are going to finish up and conclude the second part here now of medieval social thought in the 12th and 13th centuries. And we're going to finish up with two people, Marsilio of Padua, who's actually very famous, and someone who's not so famous, Thomas of Cleve, one an Italian, the other an Englishman. Marsilio is vehemently opposed to Pierre Dubois, partially because Marsilio, of really all the people of the High Middle Ages, the very beginning of the Renaissance, rejects the concept of any kind of papal interference in political office, in political life. But like everybody else we've dealt with, Marsilio holds to the view that monarchy is justified on the basis that, A, it represents the common good as opposed to the specific interests of those who are powerful. On the other hand, B, that it is based on consent. It does not exist unless it does not exist legitimately, unless it is based on the consent, the tradition of the people who are being governed. Unlike a lot of the people who we've dealt with, he does hold to the view that election is important. And people like Jacques de Sissole, and really most of the mentality of the High Middle Ages, elections are a problem only because they more or less empower those who already have a lot of social power. But Marsilio goes even further than this. He holds to the view, and this is going to become more important as the Enlightenment develops in the next couple hundred years, that the entire community, the society that is unified by the monarch, is the true legislative body. And that Marsilio also holds that although he does believe in a strong centralized monarchy, that there should be strong checks against royal authority based on the idea, generally speaking, of impeachment. So Marsilio, you see in this mentality, Marsilio of Padua has this concept of a slow, what we would call a modernization of political theory. You see this a little bit in Pierre Dubois. And the last person we're going to deal with is Thomas O'Cleve. He is an Englishman writing the High Middle Ages. He is concerned with the idea that the political world is changing always. It is always changing. It is always moving. I want you to notice in people like Marsilio, you know, Marsilio and Pierre to some extent, these are the first people who begin talking about a political ruler as somebody who is in essence a living institution. You know, almost everyone we've dealt with before has held to a very personalist approach to political virtue. A monarch rules well if he can conquer himself, if he can control his emotions. This kind of almost a psychological approach to political theory. But Dubois and Marsilio, they hold to this view that political authority is ultimately institutional. The personality of a monarch is just somebody who fills that particular role. The institution lasts forever. The individual is born, is raised, and then eventually dies. But Thomas O'Cleve is somebody who will come back to a more psychological approach. And he really is concerned at the constant change of political forms and the political mentality, even though the idea of justice remains exactly the same. O'Cleve wants to go back to the psychological approach to political theory, that a true ruler, a true monarch, should speak little, should avoid flattery, those who want to over-compliment the monarchy for the sake of political favors, and that political rule in a royal sense is based on four concepts: prudence, the ultimate virtue, temperance or moderation, but these have to be undergirded by the final two, that is strength, but not just strength based on right. If you have those four things, you cannot go wrong in terms of political rule. O'Cleve also holds to the view that a ruler should surpass the population in morals, and as a lot of the, and I haven't mentioned this, but a lot of these writers also held to the view that the monarch and those close to the monarch should be held to a higher standard than the common run of the population due to the fact that they have a privileged life. What's outrageous about the history of political ideas is that people like O'Cleve are almost completely ignored, and yet those like Thomas Hobbes are lionized to the skies. Thomas Hobbes believed that the only thing that exists is the internal passionate drive of the individual, the worst possible example you could hold to. But like all of these people, O'Cleve holds to the view that power and justice is true and right and proper, and yet in order to function properly, it must always be tempered with mercy and self-control. But O'Cleve holds that members of the society, they live in a rational society, need to be constantly assisting each other in moral development and keeping each other from falling astray. That the society is, in fact, the social manifestation of social ethics. Think of it this way. O'Cleve wants to hold to the view that justice is to the state as the soul is to the body. As the soul is the living principle of the body, the soul is the motive principle of the body, the same relationship does justice have to government. But justice is always in this era, and this will fall to pieces under the domination of the major bankers and shipping interests of the Enlightenment. This will fall apart where the justice, concept of justice is no longer based on common good, but on the domination of the powerful. Thomas O'Cleve will also add more meat to this by holding to the view that all citizens are equal under the law. And that the great as well as the low, in terms of income and class status, have rights, should be permitted to speak freely, and should be permitted to give counsel to the king if necessary. And that the council, if the formal body of the council around the monarch, serves as a check, of course, on royal power. And that a monarch, in order to truly be a monarch, rather than a tyrant, has to be someone who has to be humble when facing criticism. And again, I want to stress that all of the stuff that we've been dealing with here concerns the mentality of the High Middle Ages. This is a pre-modern approach to social ideas. When you talk about free speech, checks and balances, legislative authority, economic progress, this is not the concept of modernity. It is a concept of the Middle Ages. And that's really the revisionist point I am trying to make here, that what we're talking about with all of these writers, and number one is that they sound awfully modern, and yet they're writing in the Middle Ages. And number two, they are actively suppressed by the academic elite. When you talk about political theory, and in most people who teach political theory in American universities are normally incompetent. They only know the big names. Anybody who isn't a big name, these guys know nothing about. It's almost child abuse how these kids in college are manipulated and really just mentally destroyed by the system. And all of these people talk about free speech and progress and the common good and rights and checks and balances, and yet they're nowhere to be found in the major textbooks in social ideas and social theory. All right, so let's conclude. Given everything these last 2 hours that we've spoken of, I have eight particular points that I think deserve to be mentioned. Number one, the organic analogy. Almost everybody in the Middle Ages used the human body, or even nature as a whole, as a way to describe and understand the body politic. And really what's at the basis of this metaphor, this analogy, is that all parts of society are mutually independent. There is no individual, there is no class. Ultimately, there is only a commonality where all individuals in all classes and all corporations and all guilds need to work together for the sake of justice, the common good, and prosperity. Number two, the idea that the final end of political ideas, of political power, the justification of political power, are peace, harmony, and unity. And ultimately, when you approach social ideas from the point of view of mutual interdependence, the unity of these parts, the harmony of these parts, and then all that eventually leading to a peaceful world, a peaceful society, that is deduced logically from the organic analogy. It isn't about controlling self-interest. It's about elevating self-interest to a concept of harmony and interdependence. Rational self-interest, in the way that moderns and capitalists have defined it, is explicitly rejected in this era. Number three, and I think a lot of you have figured this out by now, that the selection choice of a queen is absolutely essential. A queen is very, very important. A queen is the chief counselor. A queen is a check on the power of the king. A queen, in a certain way, is the element of mercy, where the male monarch is the element of severity. Number four, the council is always necessary. There is no such thing as absolute monarchy. It can exist in theory, and it cannot exist in practice. No monarch could know everything. A monarch needs to be advised by specialists who come together in a more or less formal council that advises the monarch on various issues. And what really matters in these writers isn't so much that these people are elected, but that they are older, that they are wiser, that their experience has given them the right to be trusted advisors to the monarchy. And that a monarch needs to learn to just shut up, listen, stop talking. I could say this to some of my opponents on The Voice of Reason. Stop talking for 2 minutes and just listen, and listen in humility to what these people have to say. They may be smarter than you are. Number five, all monarchs, anybody who has any real right to political rule, needs to be kept to a higher standard than the average person. Those that have the charge of manifesting and enforcing the common good need to be better morally than the people who they rule. Number six, justice, the common good, has to do not necessarily with the way that the institutions are designed, but the personal qualities of the ruler. And this kind of personalism is very significant in the Middle Ages. Number seven, that the concept here is the political rule really only has two functions. The first is military, and the second is judicial. Everything else already functions. Now, this is something that's, you know, worth thinking about. These societies existed before the monarchy was created. These societies have existed long before you were born. These societies have been dealing with conflict and strife for centuries, if not millennia. You don't need to rule them. You could keep the peace. You could make sure that their customs continue to function. You could make sure that criminals are expelled and punished. But you have no right whatsoever to manipulate how these communities have been functioning for a very long period of time, because that tradition is just another word for consent. This is how we've always done things, and we've always done it this way for no other rational reason than that it's worked. And finally, all princes are under the law. The only time when a prince is not under the law is when the prince is showing mercy, which is something that a monarch should do all the time. We can apply the law in its normal severity, but for the sake of social peace, for the sake of rehabilitation, we should show some mercy in how we apply the law. The only time a monarch is above the law is when they become a tyrant. In the High Middle Ages, almost without exception, the definition of a tyrant is somebody who believes himself to be above the law, and he believes himself to be above the law on the basis that his pleasure and his will should be the dominant thing to be satisfied at any given time. There is no concept of absolute monarchy in the Middle Ages. It does not exist. It could not exist. Only when the modern scientific concept of progress, and the way we view it, develops in the Enlightenment, the very late Renaissance, only then do we have this notion of the enlightened despot. You see it in Russia, and Peter and Catherine II. The use of force and violence against an ignorant population is justified because they're ignorant and we can safely dehumanize and get rid of them, dispose of them. That's the mentality behind the Enlightenment idea. But in the High Middle Ages, you have a doctrine of progress only when it deals with the development of a money economy and a scientific worldview that does not develop into the technical fetish that you see in the Enlightenment. You know, progress is defined very differently. So what we have is monarchy based on law, advised by a council that is headed by the queen, at least in some sense, a strong stress on the personal virtues of the ruler, and the idea that a tyrant by definition cannot be a prince, and the decrees that a tyrant might promote are, again, by definition, not laws. We're based on law to the extent that this law is based on consent. A tyrant demanding X, Y, and Z, that's not a matter of law in the proper sense of the word, but is in fact merely a decree of a tyrant and therefore can be and should be ignored. And how few people truly understand this immense body of political writing in the High Middle Ages and the descent of political writing to justification, the justification of the dominance of the enlightened despotism of the Enlightenment in the very late Renaissance. And that this enlightened despot comes into existence to collect the taxes to pay back the loan sharks that have come to create and then justify the absolute monarchy. Absolute monarchy does not exist in the Middle Ages, period. I think I've just proved that. It does exist in the Enlightenment, an era based on scientific progress and the alleged free will and rights of the individual, and apparently that's not the case. The protection of the individual and of the society exists in the Middle Ages. It disappears in the Enlightenment. And this is something I think that should be taken seriously, and this is something that has served as really the ultimate thesis of what I've done here for the last 2 hours. And I'm sure you're bored of this by now. I hope I've made my point. If you have something to say, don't showboat in front of an audience, please. That just makes you look stupid. Please contact me directly and ask me a question. You know, don't worry about the attention that you might get. Just email me and ask me a question, and I'll be more than happy to give you the time that you deserve. Anyway, I appreciate you listening. I appreciate you taking this seriously. I appreciate you mulling this over. I hope I've changed your political point of view a little bit. If I haven't, it's probably my fault, but I appreciate you listening. God bless. Hang in there, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.